It was now evening, and I immediately dressed myself in the costume of an Indian. Equipped with a small hatchet, which I and my associates denominated the tomahawk, with which, and a club, after having painted my face and hands with the coal dust in the shop of a blacksmith, I repaired to Griffin's Wharf. When we arrived at the wharf, there were three of our number who assumed an authority to direct our operations, to which we readily submitted. They divided us into three parties, for the purpose of boarding the three ships, which contained the tea, at the same time. We were then ordered by our commander to open the hatches and take out all the chests of tea and throw them overboard. And we immediately proceeded to execute his orders, first cutting and splitting the chest with our tomahawks so as to thoroughly expose them to the effects of the water. In about 3 hours from the time we went aboard, we had thus broken and thrown overboard every tea chest that could be found on the ship, while those in other ships were disposing of the tea in the same way at the same time. We were surrounded by British armed ships, but no attempt was made to resist us. We then quietly retired to our several places of residence without having any conversation with each other or taking any measure to discover who were our associates. There appeared to be an understanding that each individual should volunteer his service, keep his own secret, and risk the consequence for himself. No disorder took place during that transaction, and it was observed at that time that the stillest night ensued that Boston had enjoyed for many months. George Hughes, a participant in the Boston Tea Party. And we are back to the American Revolution podcast. I once again have to apologize for the lateness of my episode. I know this has become a running theme lately, but I have just gotten a job in Delaware, and at the beginning of the week, I had to race down there to take care of some paperwork, and I came back on Tuesday. My work schedule got out of hand, so I'm sitting down, what is today, Friday, October 7th, and I have finally found some time this evening to record a podcast episode. Unfortunately, I can't say that this is going to be an uncommon event, because until I finally move to Delaware, there is going to be some weeks where I'm very in flux with my episodes. Now, I'm hoping that my schedule will allow me the few hours that I need to record an episode on Monday to try and keep up with my regularly scheduled events, where I usually try and get one out on Monday or Tuesday. So without any further ado, let's get right into this week's episode. We're up to episode 9, Tea Taxes and Tea Parties. I opened this episode with a quote from one of the participants of the Boston Tea Party. But the Boston Tea Party was just such a... It was a reaction to many other events. I wouldn't want to say that it was a small event. It is, time-wise, it's very short. It just kind of happens. But it is a reaction to what is happening in Boston, and it's the lead-up events that are going to cause the Boston Tea Party to actually happen. So, by the 1770s, Britain had few allies, and its popularity on the continent was basically non-existent. Meanwhile, back in the American colonies, the repealing of the Townshend Acts still was a pivotal moment. It quelled a lot of the hostilities that were happening at the time, with all the Acts of Parliament coming through, and the Sons of Liberty were starting fires all over the 13 colonies. So this really did a lot to dampen those fires. But with the Townshend Acts, they left a tea tax intact that we didn't really talk about, and the reason was for this future episode. See, the tea tax was, I want to say, overlooked, and it's not because the colonists didn't like tea. It's the fact that the colonists were smuggling in tea. Yes, they were smuggling in tea from places like the Netherlands, and they were getting it at a much cheaper rate than they would from the British government. So it didn't really matter to them. And I also want to say that, you know, Britain itself wasn't so squeaky clean, because some of those British merchants were also smuggling in tea and then smuggling it to America and selling it at that discounted rate. So there's a lot of smuggling going on. So the tea tax can basically be overlooked. Until, of course, something throws Massachusetts into a frenzy. I really want to know who thinks it's a good idea to ever piss off Massachusetts. I mean, even now, I definitely do not go into Boston and degrade the beloved Bo Sox. I mean, you're just asking for a bar fight. I will not, of course, lay off the Boston Bruins as a Ranger fan. I'm saying, original six teams going at it, I will always side with my beloved New York Rangers. But that's just me. So, of course, something sends Massachusetts into a tizzy. And who is it? It's that background character that I've talked about, but we don't really get an in-depth look at. And that's the royal governor, Thomas Hutchinson. You know, he's going to be in the background for part of the early years of the American Revolution, at least the Sons of Liberty years. And he'll kind of fade off into history after General Gage arrives and he now is in command of Boston itself. But for this part of our story, well, he writes some letters that describe his lack of sympathy for the issues that are bothering the Massachusetts colonists. And it's basically a series of writings and letters that are just degrading the Massachusetts people and calling them bad Englishmen, and all they do is complain and a whole bunch of trash talking. So now we have some hot-blooded Massachusetts colonists. To combat the rampant smuggling in early 1772, the Royal Navy sent the HMS Gaspee to the waters around Rhode Island. It had a simple task: stop the smugglers. And that June, of course, the Gaspee was chasing a colonial sloop, the Hannah, as it left Newport. Now, the Hannah's captain was a crafty kind of guy, and he was able to run the Gaspee aground. Well, a mob forms on shore. They take to the longboats, they head out to the Gaspee, they take the crew captive, and then they burn it. The Gaspee affair, as it became known, caught the attention of King George III. I'm actually surprised this caught the attention of him, because the guy was kind of oblivious to everything that was happening in the colonies early on. But, hey, burn a ship, get the king's attention. Good job, New England. Who, in turn, told Lord North, "We must get the colonists into order before we have to engage with our neighbor." Now, when I talk about Lord North, I'm not talking about the King of the North, sorry for your Game of Thrones fans, but I'm talking about Lord Frederick North, 2nd Earl of Guildford. He would be the acting Prime Minister from 1770 to 1782. Now, I wanted to talk a lot about Lord North, but at the same time, with so much more to talk about in our story and being only several episodes in, I wanted to cut some people. I had to cut some people in pieces out, and unfortunately he made it on the cutting room floor. So, small drop to Lord North, Prime Minister of England, but this is one of the few times you're going to hear about him. A government commission is set up to find out who was involved in the burning of the Gaspee, and they had to be prosecuted. Well, the colonists find out, and they're very sketchy ways that they go about finding out about stuff, that the commission was supposed to find those involved, and they were going to stand trial in England. So once this comes out, the colonists just button up. They're not going to say anything. So the commission comes back with no leads as to who burned the Gaspee or who was involved in it. So the British government kind of just stuck. They had to lose a British warship. This actually was a benefit to the American colonies because it spurred the creation of the Committees of Correspondence. Now, if you think back to fourth grade social studies, Committees of Correspondence took place. A lot of textbooks will tell you about Massachusetts and Virginia, but every state had a Committee of Correspondence. The Committee of Correspondence were to deal with local issues. They were made up of local people, and they were going to solve local problems. Massachusetts is the first. They set up theirs November 2nd, 1772, with Virginia following, of course, March 1773. They will be the ones to encourage contact between the colonies. That's Virginia I'm talking about. The committees themselves were made up of some of the most influential men in the colonies, such as lawyers, businessmen, and even some ex-military men. If you're thinking about the state of Virginia, I know who you're thinking, and yes, he was involved. The function was to ensure information spread within the colony and to other colonies. Now, as kind of a pain-in-the-butt situation as this could be, with the colonies talking to each other and taking it upon themselves to, quote-unquote, govern themselves, the British Parliament had much bigger problems to deal with. You see, the East India Company was facing major problems on the subcontinent. The company was accused of greed and corruption. You couple that with the fact that they were facing famine, a war, and the European credit crisis. Well, the company had no choice but to appeal to the British government for help. And what does the British government do? They help. So on March 10, 1773, they passed the Tea Act. It took away the tax on imported tea in Britain by the East India Company. This actually made tea cheaper than the smuggled stuff. Now, this is a brilliant idea. You have effectively increased the amount of importation from the East India Company, so thus building their revenue, and giving cheap, affordable tea to the British masses. So what could be wrong? Well, there's one big thing. They didn't take the tax off in the colonies. See, the tax was still intact. So what happens? Our favorite boy band finds out about this, and, well, instead of writing songs, they cause mischief. So Sons of Liberty groups will start to threaten open violence and vowed that not a barrel of tea shall be landed on this continent. This worked in the big port cities, like New York and Philadelphia. Boston, always being the hotbed of tension, it was, would once again make headlines. You see, the Sons of Liberty, like their counterparts in other major cities, would urge those who were awaiting shipments to turn them back. They also waged a war in print, pleading with those, turn back the ships, we don't want to have to fight you on this. Well, those officials either were headstrong and held strong, or were threatened from more government officials that they can't actually turn their ships around, and so the ships were coming. And the first ship to arrive was the Dartmouth. Colonists met at the Old South Meeting House, where they resolved not to pay the duties. Samuel Adams, the great orator, the firebrand, would ask a crowd of over 5,000 people, "Is it the firm resolution of this body that the tea shall not only be sent back, but that no duty shall be paid thereon?" And the crowd responded with a resounding yes. So a stalemate ensued, and the owner of the Dartmouth was stuck at an impasse, because he couldn't return to England with unloaded cargo, and Governor Hutchinson refused to let them leave without paying the duty. So what do the colonists do? Well, on the night of December 16th, At the Old South Meeting House, Sam Adams declared, "This meeting can do nothing more to save the country." Now, this was an interesting thing, because a lot of early scholarly work will show Samuel Adams saying these words, and then droves of men racing off to the wharves. And people just assumed that Samuel Adams knew that this was going to happen and gave them a signal word to say, take to the ships, dump the tea. Now, a lot of present-day historians will tell you that this may or may not be true. The great firebrand orator that Samuel Adams is, he'll say these words, but there's no guarantee that they were a signal. But unfortunately, without being behind closed doors with the high council, I guess we'll call them, of the Sons of Liberty in Boston, there's no way to tell if that was a signal or not. So we're just going to leave that open for interpretation. But nonetheless, the Sons of Liberty would not allow the tea to be landed. So that night, about 50 men, the number will always, always be over-exaggerated, but the scholarly number is around 50 men, dressed as Indians, dumped 9,000 pounds of the contested product into Boston Harbor. The British government would not stand for this, and they went to work to change things. Now, next week, or I should say Monday, because it is Friday, and I plan to have another one out by Monday or Tuesday, we're going to look at that great firebrand orator that I love so very much, Samuel Adams. The week after that, we're going to talk about what the British government tries to do to make this change happen. So I'm not going to spoil anything. I'm just going to go right into this week's recommendation. Now, unfortunately, I don't have a particular recommendation to go off of because there isn't a book solely about the Boston Tea Party. It's all, because it's such a small event in a larger group of events that kind of converge us into the American Revolution. There isn't a sole book, just like with all of the other Parliament Acts that we've been talking about, there isn't a sole book on one or the other. So we're going to take this week, and I'm going to use some of my favorite primary source material and secondary source material that are kind of all wrapped into one. And those are any good timeline book. Now, I'm not talking about like the timeline books that you see when you're a kid. And, you know, it's just pages and pages of a really long timeline about some particular type of history. But what I'm talking about is books that will give you a timeline of a particular event. And this can be applied to anything. I actually set up a whole lesson plan for the American Civil War by using one of these books because it gave you such a detailed list on such and such date this happened, on such and such date this happened. And that's what I've been using in the Smithsonian American Revolution, A Visual History. Now, I've used this as a recommendation in the past, and I'm not going to re-recommend it. But what I will say is that books that are like that are excellent, excellent sources for all your historical reading needs. So until next week, or I should say until Monday, I will be signing off for now, and we will pick this up with Samuel Adams, hopefully on Monday. So for now, this is the American Revolution Podcast. Have a good weekend, and remember, always keep your powder dry. Thank you.